Can you hear me, first of all? Yes? No? Right, so I'm totally sleepless, so you're responsible for correcting my mistakes, and the lecture will last until 4 p.m. or until I collapse, whichever comes first. So, good. So, indeed, this is, roughly speaking, a set of lectures about the ADS-CFT correspondence, supposedly at elementary level. If it isn't, you should tell me so that I can make it elementary. But the purpose of my lectures is going to be more or less to discuss the ideas of holography, of holographic dualities, and I would like to move from that to thinking in the end about the underlying states of space-time as a quantum foam, in particular, the underlying microstates of black holes as a quantum foam, and how singularities emerge from that quantum foam as an effective description. And I hope we'll be able to see that by using the ADS-CFT correspondence, we will be such ideas come out rather naturally and in a well-controlled way. Okay, but I want to start out by today will be basically lecture on basics. And let's start out by discussing what is the holographic principle, which is something that people talk about a lot. And by the way, can I just take a quick survey? How many people in this audience, barring the professors, have actually written a paper that uses the ADS-CFT correspondence? Everybody put up your hand who's done that. Okay, some people, but there's a large majority who haven't. So indeed, be sure to slow me down as necessary, okay? Okay, so what's the holographic principle? Well, roughly speaking, the holographic principle says that in a quantum theory of gravity, the number of degrees of freedom that are available in a system scales with surface area, not volume. Now, that's a crude statement, and we'll refine this as time passes. But first of all, that's a radical statement, if true at all. Hi, Dougie. And it's radical because, of course, this implies some sort of breakdown extensivity. We're used to thinking about systems where the number of degrees of freedom scales proportionally to the volume. But here we're saying that the number of degrees of freedom should scale in a theory with gravity much slower than the volume. Now, where does this idea come from? Let me remind you that this idea comes from the physics of black holes, and we will have occasion by the time these lectures end to revisit these points again and again, so it's good to remember them now. And as you know, there is an analogy between the physics of black holes and thermodynamics. So this was developed in a very nice series of papers in the early 70s by Hawking, Bekenstein, Bardeen, and Carter. So the first law of black hole mechanics says that so suppose you consider a black hole a family of black hole solutions, minus 1 minus gm over r dt squared. I'm just writing down the Schwarzschild black holes here, plus the same thing inverse dr squared, plus r squared d omega squared. And I'm even doing this in four dimensions. So dm is equal to kappa times dA, where a is the area of the horizon of the black hole. There's no chalk thing here. A great failure of the Perimeter Institute. Okay, well, there's more stuff there. Okay. The area is non-decreasing in any classical process involving black holes. And kappa, this parameter, the surface gravity, is supposed to be constant on a horizon. Now, these three laws are in formal analogy with the laws of thermodynamics. dE is equal to TdS, plus so on. The entropy is non-decreasing in classical processes. And the temperature is constant in equilibrium. There was a further theorem, equilibrium, in the early 70s called the Noether theorem that was developed that said that at least in four dimensions, black holes were completely characterized by a few numbers, their mass, charges, and angular momentum. Very recently, indeed in the last year or two, it's been discovered that this is not completely true. This is not sufficient to characterize higher dimensional black holes. And I hope, David, are you lecturing on this next week? So you'll hear more about that next week, so I'm not really going to talk about violations of the Noether theorem because that will be covered later. In any case, the thing that's of interest to me is that there's a statement here that the entropy of a black hole, that you can formally associate with the area of a black hole and entropy, area over 4 g Newton, and that you can formally associate a temperature with the surface gravity kappa. Now, in the original papers where this was suggested, it was immediately stated that obviously black holes don't radiate, so this must be just a formal analogy. And then a few years later, Hawking discovered that black holes in fact radiate because of quantum mechanics, the kind of things that Don Maroff, because of quantum field theory and curved space-time that Don Maroff has been telling you about. And therefore, this analogy is in fact exact, that in fact, black holes appear to eat information, turn the thermal bodies, and radiate the stuff off. So that, of course, leads to the information loss problem, which I will also want to come back to later in this talk. Namely, in this radiation, if it's thermal, you can't find out much about what went into the black hole. And does that mean that in the presence of black holes, unitarity is lost? That's also something that we will come back to discuss at the end of these series of lectures. Anyway, the basic idea based on this physics of black holes, people suggested that the entropy must be proportional to the area because this is not because black holes are particularly special, but because this is a fundamental property of gravity as opposed to fundamental property of black holes, and that black holes manifest this in a particularly clear way because they are the densest objects that you can build. Therefore, they sort of push the bound to its limits. Andrei, have you given lectures or are you giving lectures? No, okay. So Andrei can tell you more about that kind of bound from holography too. Okay, so there are various generalizations of this that people have talked about. So one generalization that people have talked about is instead of making a horizon out of a black hole by actually pumping lots of material into place, you could consider the space-time seen by an accelerated observer. So since you're accelerating, an accelerated observer asymptotes to the speed of light, so they're going to see an horizon because they're asymptoting to the speed of light, and such an observer sees what's called Rindler space, and you can formally associate an entropy with the horizon of Rindler space. Then there's de Sitter space, which is the simplest accelerating universe. This is the kind of thing that people patch in to describe the inflating phase of the universe. The metric here is -1 minus r squared over l squared dt squared, plus the same thing inverse, dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. And, well, this is a inflating universe as seen by an inertial observer. There's a horizon at r equals l, again, because the space is accelerating, and you can associate entropy with that. More generally, Busso has argued for something called the covariant entropy bound. And the covariant entropy bound looks like this. Suppose you have a region bounded by an area A. You make what's called a light sheet. Namely, you basically send in the ingoing light rays coming in from this perimeter and wait for them to meet. And then there's a statement, the entropy that you associate with, so things can go out there, that if you measure area over 4 g newton of this perimeter area, that is bigger than or equal to the total entropy of, what should I say, of total entropy passing through the light sheets. So this is since this is not the main topic of my lectures, I'm going through this at a somewhat rapid pace and somewhat crudely, but this is the basic idea of this bound. It's a generalization of this sort of area bound. And finally, for me, the most interesting formulation of this set of ideas comes from Jacobson, and it goes as follows. Here's the eraser. So Jacobson, this was about maybe 10 years ago, there was an interesting paper in which Jacobson pointed out the following fact. So the way we usually think about the thermodynamics of black holes is we start off with inertial observers in special relativity. We impose the equation of the motion, and we require the equivalence principle to be true. And if you require both of these things to be true, you more or less derive that gravity must be governed by Einstein's equations. And furthermore, then using Einstein's equations and thinking like Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking did, you can figure out that black holes and horizons in general are supposed to have some kind of entropy. So Jacobson went through the following exercise. He considered families of locally accelerated observers. So these are not inertial observers at all. And of course, a family of locally accelerated observers are all going to see horizons, because let's suppose they're all accelerating here. So one accelerates and goes like that, one accelerates and goes like that. So if you do that, well, so here's the space-time diagram. You know, one does this, one does this, one does this. Here's x and t. Then all of them are going to see a horizon. And Jacobson said, I will not assume that the laws of general relativity apply at all. Sorry, yes, that's right. And instead, he assumed the following funny thing. He said, let's suppose that you have this horizon, and you have some energy, delta E, that passes through this horizon. He assumed that that must imply that if you compute, you can, that implied the following things. So delta E, the energy passing through, must be equal to T delta S. Delta S was equal to delta A, which is A is the area of the horizon, divided by 4g Newton. And the T was the local unrho temperature, unrho temperatures being the temperatures that accelerated observers see in, well, observers see in accelerated frames. Have you covered that yet in the lectures on field theory and curved space? Yes? Okay, so this was the local accelerate. So basically, he assumed that if you made up a horizon, you know, faked the horizon by thinking about accelerated observers, families of accelerated observers, that the laws of, if you like, thermodynamics would apply to these horizons. So he just assumed this. He then also assumed a very general equation called the Ray-Chowdhury equation. And the Ray-Chowdhury equation is simply a statement about geometry. It says something called expansion, dd lambda, is equal to r mu nu k mu nu k mu lambda. K mu here was a vector pointing tangent to the horizon. R mu nu is local curvature. So these are purely geometric statements that don't involve any equations of motion. And he proved that if you assume these facts about geometry, which are true, and assume that the laws of horizon mechanics had to hold, that you would derive Einstein's equations as the equation of motion of gravity. So the thing that I find remarkable about this, and I'm going to erase this here now, is bad idea. The thing that I find remarkable about this is it says that the laws of horizon thermodynamics are equivalent to the equations of motion of gravity. In effect, what's being said is that equations of state, which we usually associate with, you know, collective variables, you know, the collective behavior of this gas in this room, et cetera, but equations of state are the same thing as equations of motion. And equations of motion are things that we usually associate with, you know, fundamental fields, as opposed to sort of collective variables of one sort or the other. So to me, at least, this is a very dramatic statement and raises the question, I'll put meaning question mark, because it's only a question, whether gravity and space-time itself are simply effective emergent concepts that are some kind of long wavelength approximation to the underlying variables. Another way of saying this is just as the thermodynamics of gases can be derived from the statistical mechanics of atoms, you could raise the question from this, what are the atoms of space-time? And just like for a gas, you could ask the question, what are the underlying microstates of the gas in this room that give rise to the entropy of this of the gas in this room? You could ask, what are the microstates of smooth and singular space-time geometries? So I think this sort of very general argument by Jacobson at least raises these questions for me. And the most concrete setting in which I know where these kinds of ideas can be explored is the ADS-CFT correspondence. So I'm basically going to try to explore these ideas in the context of ADS-CFT, as a means of explaining some ideas from ADS-CFT to you, and also as a means of exploring the sort of cool set of things. Okay, so how are we going to do this? So that's the plan. So let me set up the plan for the lecture that I'm going to give here. So there's going to be four steps, basically following through. I would like to get at these ideas. What are the atoms of space-time? What are the microstates of smooth and singular geometries? I'm going to do that in ADS-CFT. So we're going to start out today by discussing the ADS-CFT correspondence, or the aspects of the ADS-CFT correspondence that are relevant for me. So I will call. So I'll have some generalities and techniques that I will develop today. I hope some of these techniques have been actually built up already in the previous lectures by Sujong Ray, and so I'll go relatively fast. But if it seems novel to you, you should stop me and please ask me questions, okay? So that I can adjust the pace as necessary. Then secondly, I will discuss the black hole spacetimes in black holes in ADS spacetimes, because that is a crucial part of the thinking over here. Then third, I'm going to discuss supersymmetric states of the theory, in particular, half BPS states. For those who are not familiar with the idea of BPS states, I will explain what this means. I will explain, I will discuss the physics of half BPS states, both from the perspective of the field theory dual to ADS spacetimes and the perspective of the string theory itself in ADS spacetimes. We will understand that in detail. And the reason this is interesting is half BPS states have many useful non-renormalization properties that I assume will be talked about by Philip. Will probably discuss some of these things. Yes, Philip? Okay, then I will say that's true, actually, because all the lectures are very brief. So anyway, states that have, in theories with extended supersymmetry, states that break part of the supersymmetry have useful renormalization properties. I will tell you what the properties are without explaining where they come about. So that will become a very useful laboratory for testing various of the ideas that we're going to present. And then finally, I will argue to you that the states underlying many smooth and singular space-time, and the underlying states are actually form a sort of quantum foam, and that we can see that using the generalities that I will discuss today and these things about the half-BPS states, that there is such a thing as a quantum foam, and that the usual singular descriptions with horizons, et cetera, that we give in many space-times are the effective long wavelength behavior that correctly describes the universal part of any correlation function you might wish to compute in these quantum folds. At least that's what we're going to try to arrive at by the end of the lecture, if I get there. Okay? So this is so that's the introduction. Any questions? And in particular, is the handwriting big enough for people in the back? Anybody in the back, say anything. Yes? Thank you. Okay, here we go. Any questions? I'm going to have to start picking on random people. Bartek, any questions? It's useful to have your student in the audience. No questions? Good. Okay. Okay. So step one is now, today, basically, we're going to discuss the ADS. I'm going to set up the ADS-CFT correspondence for you in the language that I need for the physics that will follow in the lectures that are in the next couple of days. Okay. So let me start out by discussing global ADS spacetimes. So these are universes, as you well know, that have a negative cosmological constant. The chalk keeps fragmenting. It's turning into quantum foam. The metric for a global ADS spacetime looks like this. You have minus 1 plus r squared over l squared dt squared plus the same thing inverse dr squared plus r squared times d omega squared. A convenient change of coordinates is to say r is equal to l times the tangent of rho, where rho now, here r ran between 0 and infinity, rho runs between 0 and pi over 2. So in that coordinate system, this is minus secant squared rho dt squared plus l squared d rho squared plus l squared tan squared rho d omega squared. Okay? So let's draw a picture of this. At each radial position, there's clearly a cylinder. So overall, the whole thing is a sort of solid cylinder. The boundary at infinity is at r equals infinity, or equivalently at rho goes to pi over 2. And the boundary is also a cylinder. It's an SD. So this was SD plus 1. What was this? OK, so this was a, well, it's a cylinder. Depends on how many dimensions you're in. So it's a sphere times a line. The circle, the time is a line going up, and then the rest of it is a sphere. The boundary is a sphere here. Yes? David, you look doubtful. Are you doubtful? Oh, I am very glad, because otherwise I'm in trouble. It's early to make mistakes. Okay, so that's what an ADS spacetime looks like. A salient property that will reappear in various different guises as we keep going, even in the physics of black holes, is that if you stand in the middle of an ADS space and you throw a ball away from you, after a little while, the stupid thing comes back. So there you go. The geodesics look like that. Of course, this is the reason why before ADS-CFT, when any of us came to that page in Hawking and Ellis that described ADS spaces, we quickly turned over. Because who wants to look at a space that does such a stupid thing? But of course, that turns out to be the great virtue in some ways, as we will see, of these spaces, particularly as toy models, but we'll discuss that more later. Anyway, another coordinate system that I will use repeatedly. So by the way, again, as I said, the boundary here is an SD cross time, SD minus cross R. There's a sphere times time is a line going up. There's another coordinate system called the Poincaré patch, which we'll also use extensively. And in that coordinate system, the metric looks like minus dt squared plus dx squared plus dz squared. Z is the radial variable. This gets divided by z squared. And z goes to 0 is the boundary. And the boundary obviously looks like a plane, looks like rd, 1. So that patch is embedded in the global spacetime like this. It makes a wedge. And so the horizon of the Poincaré patch at z equals infinity is this surface and this surface. And z equals 0 is this little thing at infinity. A small annoyance that I have never completely come to grips with myself, and which I don't think anyone has satisfactorily explained to me, is that in the relationship between the Poincaré patch physics and the global physics, the way you have to get between them is you have to patch many patches together. And what's more, if you look at this picture, the point at infinity is identified. Right? That's the only way in which you embed this into this global thing. However, when people talk about the physics of Yang-Mills theory, they often want to talk about the physics on a plane. It's more convenient to talk about the physics on a plane than a cylinder for many purposes. And people just treat this plane as the plane and not the plane with the points at infinity identified. That surely has some kind of subtle effects, hopefully not for the results that people calculate. I just point that out in case some bright spark in the audience can enlighten me as to what one should be in general doing about that. OK, so that's the two. That's ADS space as a classical geometry. So now, in string theory, because of the general annoyance that we always start off in 10 or 11 dimensions, you always want to get additional, you know, this is with a d-dimensional ADS space-time, you're always going to get additional components. So you always get ADS cross M, and this could be a 10-dimensional or 11-dimensional geometry. So for example, the popular example, the most popular example, the most symmetric examples to study are ADS 5 cross S5, which I will spend a lot of time on, and which I believe Su Jong would have discussed in the context of Yang-Mills theory. Yes? Yes? Please say yes. Thank you. What about ADS 3 cross S3? Has that been discussed? No. Good. Then there's ADS 4 cross S7 and ADS 7 cross S4. Both of these are set, plus S4, these arise from 11 dimensions. This always has an additional four torus or something going wrong for the ride. This arises from type 2b string theory. And we'll discuss the physics of mostly these. We will mostly ignore these. And of course, you can make up many more examples in many different ways. So for example, one simple way of making up more examples of ADS spaces in string theory is to use the procedure of orbifolding. What an orbifold, as many of you know, is you take some space-time, like say, for example, the plane, here's R2, and you make identifications in it. You identify this line with this line. That, of course, makes a cone, right? You can make many other kinds of identifications. So identifying the S5 by elements of its isometry group produces more singular, other singular examples with less symmetry of the ADS-CFT correspondence. You can make identifications in the ADS side, by the way. You can construct black hole-like spacetimes like that. And there are many other things you can do. You can replace these nice symmetric spaces inside with various kinds of interesting manifolds. And presently, one of the exciting things to do in the field is precisely to replace these S5s by other classes of constant curvature manifolds. So there's a whole industry of doing interesting things with this. And you basically do that to cut down the amount of symmetry that's available in the system, to study things that are more like QCD or for other purposes to study theories with lower supersymmetry, as we will discuss later. Anyway, so in string theory, it always comes equipped with stuff like that. So let me also add can orbifold replace the S5s, replace SD with other things, etc. Okay. Mostly for my purposes, I don't really care for the arguments I'm making about the spaces with less symmetry. So I'm mostly going to stick to the cases with spheres in them. There'll be a couple of cases, situations where breaking that symmetry will be helpful for me. And when I do that, I will tell you. But you can pretty much expect that everywhere I'll be discussing these two cases. Okay. So what is the definition of the ADS-CFT correspondence? I am not going to go through the prehistory of this correspondence. I'm not going to tell you how it was discovered that the equations I'm going to write are true. But anyway, for our purposes, we just want to use it as a tool to calculate. So in that spirit, at the field theory level, so I've gone down from string theory to just the field theory degrees of freedom. At the field theory level, you can pretty much define the correspondence the following way. You construct the path integral over all fields, e to the I s of phi, s is the action, and phi are all the fields, subject to the boundary condition that phi approaches some values phi naught on the boundary of the space. So phi approaches phi naught, and that's a full function on the boundary of the space. And the statement is that, so this is string theory in the space-time, and that associated with each particular ADS space-time, there is a conformal field theory, more to be said about precisely which in which case later. And this thing generates the correlation functions of the conformal field theory according to this equation, e to the I, dm is the boundary of the bulk space-time, phi naught O. And so this is in the CFT. So let me just sort of uncompress the notation here. For each bulk field, phi, there is a dual operator O. And I will tell you how that operator is determined in a little while. For the boundary condition of the field phi, there is a source for the operator O, phi naught. So this is just like adding a source in a field theory. The bulk isometries of the ADS space, the sphere, etc., translate into the global symmetries of the dual theory, and so on and so forth. It's always useful to have an example. So, another empty blackboard. Good. So, actually, it's just right here. So let's just do an example. And I hope that, and I'm sure that in Sujong's lectures, what I'm going to write down here was written down at some point, but doesn't hurt to be reminded. Consider the duality between ADS5 cross S5, or string theory in such a space-time, 2B string theory in such a space-time, and the n equals 4, and I'll come back to the meaning of that in a moment, superconformal SUN gauge theory on the boundary of the manifold, which I've already specified is that cylinder over there if you're working global coordinates, or this plane if you're working in the planar coordinates. Okay. So n here refers to the number of supersymmetries. So this is four dimensions. So each supercharge is a four-component supercharge, four real-component supercharge, let's say. And then what happens is that 4 times 4 is 16. So this is 16 supercharges. But it's a superconformal theory. So that increases the number of effective supercharges here to 32. In the end, you're going to have 32 supercharges in the system if you include the superconformal ones. So it's a ridiculously symmetric theory. That's fine for our purposes, because we'll learn lots of good stuff using it anyway. Okay, so there's a lot of supersymmetry here, and lots of other symmetries that we will play with a lot in the coming lectures. The other things that I want to mention here, at the present moment anyway, is that this space, ADS5, has an isometry group, and the isometry group is, for any ADS space, is SOD, 2, so here that will be SO4, 2. The way you see that is any ADS space-time can be written as a solution to the equations minus u squared minus v squared plus x1 squared plus x2 squared, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, equals L squared. That defines a hyperboloid, and it's obvious that the group rotating this hyperboloid is SOD, 2, right? So from that, you can see that the isometry group that's going to descend from this embedding equation is going to be some SOD, 2. So you get some SO4, 2 here. Cross SO6, which is the isometry group of S5. We're going to need this quite a bit in the coming lectures. The SO6 turns out as an R-symmetry group. It rotates the supersymmetries of the Yang-Mills theory. We'll say much more about that later. And the SO4, 2 is simply the conformal group of the Yang-Mills theory. SO4, 2 is the conformal group in the dual theory. Okay, good. So, the next thing that I need is, remember that in the ADS spacetime, there's a scale L. You can relate the scale L to the parameters of the Yang-Mills theory in the following way. It's equal to G squared Yang-Mills, the square of the Yang-Mills coupling, times N, which is the rank of the gauge group raised to the power of 1/4, times the string length. That's the ADS scale in this correspondence. And the square of the Yang-Mills coupling is set equal to the string coupling in the spacetime. And G string N, therefore, is equal to the Toft coupling of the Yang-Mills theory. I understand from Sujong that you guys discussed the Toft limit and Toft couplings and perturbation theory with the Toft coupling. Yes? Yes? Okay, good. Okay, so this is that Toft coupling. And so I've now set up the parameters that I'm going to keep using in later lectures. There is a similar map, of course, there's a similar map of parameters, of course, in each particular case, but we won't go through that in detail. In each particular case, you've got to work out what the precise correspondence is. In fact, in some ways, one of the things that you'd wish you would understand better about things like the ADS-CFT correspondence is, so to speak, where they come from. We discover these dualities on a happenstance basis. You know, you make some special case of ours. Special set of arguments in each case to identify all of these parameters and show what the duality is. It would be much nicer if we knew where it came from, so that, you know, without having to go through the rigmarole of the argument every time, you could just say the dual to this is this and it had to be that way. But we don't yet have a way of doing that. Anyway, it is particularly useful to study this duality in the semi-classical limit. And not surprisingly, the semi-classical limit can be understood as taking the scale of the space-time over the Planck length and sending it to infinity, which is the same thing as sending h bar to 0. Again, not surprisingly, you expect h bar to 0 to be a semi-classical limit, or n to infinity. You can work out that all of these things work out basically doing the same thing. And I can't read my own handwriting. OK, we'll make it up. So what you do then is, in this limit, if you look at this, so what's going to happen if you take a semi-classical limit in any path integral, the path integral settles down to its saddle points, right? It's dominated by its saddle points. So in the semi-classical limit, it must be the case that the saddle points here are related to the effective action of the conformal field theory in that side. So writing that equation down, we have e to the I classical action, and I'm going to put this as a functional of phi naught, because, of course, it's the classical action for field configurations that approach phi naught at infinity. So this e to the I s classical of phi naught is supposed to be equal to e to the I times the generating function of correlation functions of the dual field theory. So specifically, how do you use this? And in the remainder of this lecture, I'm going to sort of repeat this several times to sort of produce to see various interesting things about the ADS-CFT correspondence. How do you use this? Well, you know, how do you use a generating function of correlation functions? You differentiate to get the correlation functions. Okay, so let's do that. 1 over n factorial, dn times the classical action of the functional phi naught, d phi naught n, evaluated at phi naught equals 0, is supposed to be equal to the vacuum correlation functions of the operator O. Okay. So this is the basic formula from which pretty much everything else follows in the ADS-CFT correspondence. And one of the efforts that you would immediately want to go to is to think of, is to ask yourself the question, wait a minute. This is, let's say, if you're thinking about ADS-5 CFT correspondence, that's a four-dimensional CFT, and there's really a bulk 10-dimensional space-time, ADS-5 plus S-5. How does a four-dimensional field theory know anything about a 10-dimensional universe with gravity? You know, where does the space-time comes from? How does it emerge from the dynamics of the Yang-Mills theory? So that's sort of what I want to keep in the back of my mind in the remainder of this lecture and in the next couple of days. That's going to be sort of our focus. In effect, already you're seeing that some of what I said before about, you know, I said something about what are the atoms of geometry, right? If we believe that gravity is simply an effective concept, some of that is already coming out in the very formulation of this correspondence. We have just claimed that the correct quantum theory of gravity around a certain background is equivalent to a field theory that has no, that doesn't have that space-time and doesn't have gravity in sight at all. Right? So it's incumbent upon us to understand how those things emerge. Anyway, and in field theory, we are also instructed that everything you want to know about a field theory is somehow stored in the set of all correlation functions that you can compute. So in principle, here we have all the data you can compute in the field theory, and somehow this should be telling us everything there is to know about how space-time emerges from something that doesn't have space-time. That's what we want to sort of keep in mind. But before we can do that, we have to build up still more technique, because there's, you know, lots more, there's lots more bits and pieces that we have to assimilate in order to be able to think about that. And the next thing that we want to think about is, since we are in Lorentzian signature here, we could do this in Euclidean signature, but it's much more fun in Lorentzian signature, because in Lorentzian signature you have dynamics, you've got black holes, you've got cosmological singularities, you know, interesting things happen. Well, you live, you die, whatever. Okay, good. So you'd like situations with time, so you'd like to work in Lorentzian signature. And Lorentzian signature, it's immediately evident that there's actually some subtleties in what I have just said. I'm going to write down the title for this next subsection. So I'm going to say, in Lorentzian signature, you've got to worry about states, sources, and S matrices. And basically what I'm going to tell you is how to think about states, about the Hamiltonian formulation of this thing, and how to think about the S matrix for the space-time, the scattering matrix in this language. Okay, so the basic difficulty that arises in Lorentzian signature is this. Notice that I've just said that to evaluate this thing, the semi-classical limit, you should evaluate this action on its saddle points and plug the action in and then take all its derivatives. Now, of course, so it turns out that if you're working in Euclidean signature, the equation of motion that you have to solve, and I'll write these out in detail in a bit, is elliptic. And there's a unique solution given the boundary conditions. Okay? So that means you'll get one saddle point, you can plug it in, and this is a well-defined equation. But of course, in Lorentzian signature, it's not an elliptic equation, it's a hyperbolic equation, so you get many solutions that approach phi naught at infinity. And this is more or less in correspondence with the fact that there are many states. Okay? So let's just elucidate this a little bit. So I'm going to do in ADS space some of what, you know, baby version of the kinds of things that Don has been talking about. Basically, I'm going to try to see what would I do if I was trying to do the field theory of a scalar field in ADS space. You know, what would happen and what kinds of states are there, and then that'll help me understand this potential ambiguity. So let phi, for our purposes, be a scalar of mass m. And that, of course, is going to have an equation of motion. Box phi is equal to m squared phi. And let's solve it and see what we can learn. Okay, so we can do this in any coordinate system you choose. So for my purposes, let me just pick the Poincaré coordinate system, just because. And remember there that the metric is ds squared is l squared over z squared times minus dt squared plus dx squared plus dz squared. Okay. So now I need to solve the wave equation. So obviously, there's an isometry in the x and t directions. So it would pay the Fourier transform. So let's write the field phi as e to the minus I omega t plus I k dot x times chi. So you can now plug this into the equation that fit in the metric and stuff like that, and you will find the equation z squared dz squared. Probably should be giving this to you as an exercise or something, but oh well, too late. D chi minus n squared plus d squared over 4 plus k squared minus omega squared z squared acting on chi is 0. That's easy to solve, as it turns out, and you can write the solutions in the following way. So I'm going to write the solutions down and talk about their properties as we go down here. We'll have an e to the I kx minus I omega t, a z to the d over 2 times one term, which is some constant, times the Bessel function, j nu qz, plus some other constant, phi naught, well, this can be a function, actually, y nu of qz, okay? And so this is the Neumann function. And remember, the boundary of the space-time occurs as z goes to 0. So here we go. We have z goes to 0. And as z goes to 0, this approaches a times z to some parameter 2h plus that I will define in a second, times e to the I kx minus I omega t, plus phi naught times z to the 2h minus. I'll define that in a moment, e to the I kx minus I omega t. And I think I forgot to define q squared is equal to k squared minus omega squared. Okay, so now let me define those two parameters, and then we can talk about what this means. 2h plus minus is equal to d over 2 plus or minus square root of d squared plus 4m squared over 2. And this is also equal to d over 2 plus or minus nu, where nu is the index of this Bessel function. Okay, so I think I've defined all my parameters here. Notice, therefore, that as we go off to infinity, we could write this as phi n for phi nn. Phi n is this first piece. As you go off to the boundary, that is z equals 0, this dies away, it goes to 0, whereas this diverges, correct? And if you work out the consequences by putting, so now what you can do is you can work out the norm of these solutions. So I'm going to come down here for a second, work out the Klein-Gordon norm of these solutions. This is equal to integral root g t times phi partial t phi. So you work out the Klein-Gordon norm, and you'll find that this fluctuation is normalizable in the sense that it has a finite norm, and this fluctuation is not normalizable. That motivates a distinction in this background between modes that fluctuate and that you can quantize by putting A's and A daggers next to them, because you can put A's and A daggers next to these modes, and these you can't quantize because they don't have a finite norm. There are subtleties in the statement. At certain masses, both these things have finite norm. If you want to change, if you want to deform the boundary theory by adding boundary terms, if you want to deform the boundary theory by insisting that you work around a background where it's always true that the boundary value doesn't approach phi naught, but something else, there are further subtleties, but we can discuss that all. We should keep those discussions aside. There's this basic divisions between the normalizable and the non-normalizable component of the thing. So this. What's that? You mean as they oscillate? The Bessel functions certainly go through 0, but that's just the oscillation going through 0. The wave functions just have some nodes. Okay, so in that sense, we're just treating these things as wave functions. Okay, these things fluctuate, and these things don't. So these are the boundary conditions. Okay, very good. So let's draw a little picture. Understand how to think about this. So let's see. So the way to think about this is I already said that in ADS space, if I think about it globally, if you throw a ball away from you, it comes back. In effect, that means that the space-time implements a potential well for objects. So we can think about a potential well here. And we all know if you have a particle in a potential well and you compute its wave functions, what happens? It sort of oscillates in the middle and then dies off as the, you know, when you come to the turning point, the classical turning point. So indeed, the normalizable modes are the ones that sort of die off like that, and the non-normalizable ones are things that increase in that manner. And we then think about the fine non-normalizable. If you insist upon turning on one of these modes, these non-normalizable modes, you think about this as I said, deforming the asymptotics of the space-time, because it's deforming the asymptotic value of the fields. And according to the correspondence, as I stated it earlier, this corresponds to a deformation of the field theory dual by SCFT goes to the action of the CFT plus a deformation term, which involves this phi naught times the dual operator O. So suppose instead of studying the ADS-CFT correspondence, you wish to study a field theory that isn't conformal, but has been deformed away from its conformal point by in some way. Now, a very simple way to deform things away from their conformal point is you add an operator that isn't marginal to the theory, and then you know things flow. So, well, if you do that, the statement, so if you take one of the operators of this conformal field theory dual and you add it in, the statement is that that's like turning on in the space-time one of these non-normalizable modes that deform the edges of the space. That is a very powerful thing to do in the ADS-CFT correspondence, and there's an enormous literature. I think Ofer Aharoni will discuss some of these things in his lectures, so I will not say very much more about that at this point, but you should remember this for syncing with his lectures, that this is the kind of thing that he's going to talk about. Okay, I should also say that phi normalizable then is supposed to correspond to a state, and the way you make a state in a conformal field theory is by applying an operator to the vacuum. Now, the first statement I'd like to make is that the conformal dimension of this operator is supposed to, which I'll call delta from now on in the next, from now on till the end of my lectures, is equal in this situation to this number 2h plus that we computed here. That's how you make the identification, and we're going to keep using this repeatedly in later on in the lectures. And just to remind you about how, some of you will be familiar with conformal field theory, some of you won't. I can't develop all of conformal field theory here, but just to remind you what this delta means, it's something like this. Suppose we take a two-dimensional conformal field theory, make it Euclidean, and evaluate it on the plane. On a plane, you can write the metric of the plane ds squared is equal to dr squared plus r squared d theta squared, right? That's polar coordinates on a plane. In a Euclidean conformal field theory, what you would do is you'd apply an operator O to the origin, and then if you sort of integrate fields around the perimeter, you would see that this operator applied to the origin has created the state. The way you map this into the Lorentzian setting is more or less you take the, you set r is equal to e to the t. That turns the metric into ds squared is equal to e to the 2t times dt squared plus d theta squared. And so you can work that out there easily. And then what you do is you remove, since it's a conformal field theory, you remove the conformal factor, and then you wick rotate t to it. That's how you get the theory on the cylinder. That's a schematic for how you go from the Euclidean conformal field theory to the Lorentzian conformal field theory. Well, in the Euclidean case, the eigenvalues of r dr are the, this is the, this gives you the scaling dimension of the operator, of the relevant field. So this is, this the eigenvalue of r dr is, delta, the conformal dimension, is the eigenvalue of RDR, and that maps in the Lorentzian setting to the eigenvalue of DT, which is the Hamiltonian. So mostly, I'm going to be interested in the Lorentzian setting where I'm talking about conformal field theories on the cylinder. So when I'm going to use the word conformal dimension all the time, but you can map that in your mind to Hamiltonian if you want, because what I'm going to be talking about is the energy of states in the conformal field theory. It just so happens, since it's a conformal field theory, I can map it to the plane and talk about its conformal dimension. Okay, just setting up that notation. Any questions? Okay, I'm almost done with this rapid review. By the way, if some of you are confused, which I hope you aren't, it's perfectly fair because, you know, these things took the community years to figure out. And some of these things are still confusing. So if you have questions, you should ask me. Please do. Yes. Yeah. Well, if you say you have a non-renormalizable mode, you know that it's the mode of some field. And for each field in the theory, there's supposed to be a map into the CFD. The first thing you do is you have to check the symmetries, right? So for example, things with no indices map things with no indices in that way. Also, you can check things like the conformal dimension, right? You can check the scaling behavior near infinity. And the scaling dimension tells you what the conformal dimension, scaling behavior, tells you the conformal dimension of the dual operator. So then you look in the list of operators that you can write down, things with the right symmetry and the right conformal dimension. If you're lucky, there's one. If there's more than one, then in the bulk, you should expect to find more than one field with those symmetry properties. And then you need to find the right linear combinations. And there's a certain amount of trickery that will be involved. Okay, so we're nearly there. So one thing that you can try to do with this is, okay, great, you know, you can construct field theory in the bulk and things like this. So let me discuss some points about that. So the next thing to ask if you're trying to do field theory in these situations, and that's, of course, the way to build yourself up all the way to string theory, is to start by doing classical physics and then to do field theory. Is this thing still on? I think so. Good. So the next thing to ask is, what is the vacuum if I set up some system like this? So the vacuum in these theories is unique. Is unique in ADS. What I mean by that is that if you want to pick a state that is annihilated by all the isometry generators of the space-time, there's only one. That's also true in flat space, but it's not true in de Sitter space, for example. So, but it's true here. So if you, so that there is a distinguished state that respects the symmetries of ADS space. So that's the vacuum. And in that vacuum, you can compute the Feynman propagator. And I'll write the Feynman propagator as B, Z, B prime, Z prime. B are coordinates. I'm working in Poincaré coordinates still, just because I feel like it. And Z is the radial coordinate. And B are the other coordinates, T, X, et cetera. OK? So I'm just writing down the Feynman propagator schematically. And you find it in the usual way. Solve, you know, box phi is equal delta function with the appropriate boundary conditions. And you can find this, if you like. OK, so this is Feynman propagator. And the Feynman propagator is to be understood as, here's ADS space. I've taken a slice through it. If you want to ask what is the chance of propagating from here to here, well, the Feynman propagator gives you the sum on paths for going from there to there. Another object you can compute is you can take the limit as z goes to 0, namely take this point and send it to the boundary of the following quantity, z to the minus 2h plus, Feynman propagator, b, z, b prime, z prime. And this object goes by the name of, well, I use this notation, bulk boundary. This is the so-called bulk boundary propagator. Okay? And the bulk boundary propagator is something that propagates you, if you like, from the boundary into the bulk. Notice that I remove the scaling part of it. And that's because if you don't, well, as we've already noticed, all the mode solutions either go to 0 or to infinity near the boundary. So it's going to happen that this thing is going to have funny scaling behavior near the boundary. The Feynman propagator is. And you need to remove that in order to get something that can propagate data from the boundary into the bulk. Why do you need this? The reason you need this is normally when we do field theory or any kind of field theory in flat space, all you need to do to specify the behavior of the theory is the Cauchy problem. You pick an equal time slice. You tell me everything there is to know about the fields on that equal time slice. And I tell you what it's like for the rest of time. This is, of course, not the case in anti-de Sitter space-time, because the boundary is time-like. And in addition to data that may be specified here and then propagate up, you can specify data here to propagate in. So if you like, you can use the Feynman propagator to propagate data up from earlier times. And you use the bulk boundary propagator to propagate data in for the boundary of the space. And you clearly need both of these objects to construct field theory in the space. So what can you do with this? Well, so here's what you can do. So remember, earlier on, I had written an equation for the correlation function to the theory in which you differentiate, you vary the effective, you vary the bulk action with respect to the boundary values. And, well, earlier, I had written this equation that, you know, e to the I s classical as function of phi naught is supposed to be equal to e to the I generating function of this, and then you differentiate s to find all the correlation functions. Do you remember this? Louder and in chorus. Thank you. Okay, good. So we had said this earlier. Now I'm going to give you a different formulation of the same computation of correlation functions that's useful, that sometimes is more useful. So let me describe that. So what you do is, first I'll draw the picture, then I'll write the equation. So the picture is like this. Here is the boundary of the anti-de Sitter spacetime. For the moment, let's take this to be an equal time slice. So I'm computing equal time correlators. I don't have to, but I choose to. Here are the points in the boundary where I want to put the operators O, and I want to compute the correlation function. Here's what you do. Let's say this is point B1, here's point B2. You propagate data in using the bulk boundary propagator. This is G bulk boundary. Here's the point X1 that they propagate to. You propagate data in from there to X2. And then, you know, you draw Feynman diagrams. You know, whatever. Whatever diagrams the theory allows. You write down all of these things. And then this computes for you the CFT correlation function. So basically, just like doing field theory, you string together your external states using vertices and propagators, and then you just sort of integrate over all the intermediate points. Schematically, suppose you want to compute OB1 to OBN, what you would do is you would then, how's this? You say, okay, so now integrating over all coordinates that are free, we have G bulk boundary of B1, X1, G bulk boundary of B2, X2, da 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 da. G Feynman of X1, X2, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, times vertex factors, et cetera. Vertex factors, et cetera. Now, of course, I'm sort of doing this schematically for a single scalar field, but if you have, you know, gauge fields, gravitons, whatever you want, things with many indices, put in the appropriate propagators, contract every index in sight to get a scalar, and it'll compute for you what you want. So this is supposed to be the prescription for doing things. But notice, this is all very nice, and in principle contains all data that there is to know about the CFT. Remarkable things have been found using this, using this kind of relation. But the thing that we most wanted, or what I set up at the beginning of this lecture to be the thing I really wanted, is hard to get. That is to say, local information about space-time is very hard to get in this way. And the reason it's so hard to get is, you know, look at it. Anything you compute in the CFT, if you like, integrates over everything in the bulk. Right? So how do you find out what's going on at any given place, which is what you need if you wish to answer the question, how does space-time, if you like, emerge from a thing that doesn't have space-time in it? Just to be specific, suppose I just wish to compute the two-point function. So here's one thing, and here's another thing, and I want to compute the two-point function between these 2 points. Well, so I want to compute O of B1, O of B2. Okay. This is, according to the formula I've just written, the limit as z and z prime goes to 0 of the Feynman propagator b, z, b prime, z prime. Here's one point, here's another point, then I take the two bulk points and send them off to the boundary, but the two bulk points go to the boundary. I need to do some rescalings here that I won't bother about to stay in sync with my prescription over there. And of course, since I'm computing the Feynman propagator, I can rewrite this calculation the following way. We need to sum over paths, e to the I, the mass of the particle that's going through these paths, divided by h bar, times the length of the path. So here's the boundary, and, you know, we're summing over all of these paths. So in the semi-classical limit, we can write this as OO, the two-point correlation function, is a sum on geodesics, because, of course, the saddle points of this equation, the minimum length paths, are the geodesics. So it's a sum on geodesics between the two boundary points of e to the I, m over h bar, times the length of the geodesic. So this immediately tells us a very powerful thing. And the powerful thing it tells us is this. Suppose you have, this is the boundary. You have two points close together and you want to compute the correlation function. The relevant geodesic will do this. Here are two points far away. The relevant geodesics will do this. So what this tells you immediately is that infrared physics, the physics of long distances in the conformal field theory, probes the interior, probes the deep interior. So one of the things that we will try to develop is to try to be more quantitative about this. In what sense does the infrared physics of the Yang-Mills theory encode the interior, while the UV physics encodes the regions near the boundary? OK, I want to make a couple more comments here, and then we're going to shift gears into a slightly different direction. And I want to make some comments about vacuums, states, and transition amplitudes. I'm not actually going to say anything substantive, because this is a somewhat complicated topic. But another kind of, all the time here, I've been insisting on computing vacuum correlation functions, right? Vacuum with operators stuck in between. But you might have wanted to compute the expectation value of some set of operators in a state. You might have also wanted to compute transition amplitudes. What happens if you stick in some operators and you have some states? So I just want to say that, OK, so the way you might construct a state is by applying an operator OS at t goes to minus infinity to the vacuum, and then writing these things down. But I just wanted to say that one has to be, I don't have time to develop the details, but there are nice papers by Starnetz and Son, and also by Don Marolf, which develop what you need to do in these situations. And it's subtle. There are issues about how you set up your boundary conditions, how you set up your states, and things like that. So if you wish to do calculations of that kind, I recommend that you go do some reading. You shouldn't immediately jump in without seeing a little bit about what's been done about setting up those states. Okay? I'm now about to switch gears, talking about in a slightly different way, rather than talking about field theory and how you do these calculations. So now is the time to ask me questions about this. Anybody? Diego. I'm just picking on anybody whose name I know. Bartek. No questions? You sure? Ah. No, if you want to stay in a CFD, then they're related to marginal deformations. But you don't necessarily want to stay in a CFD. Sometimes, there's very nice work done in which, for example, you deform the CFD by some non-marginal operator, and then observe the flow, and then the CFD, in the CFD, you can compute the renormalization group flow. We're going to talk more about the holographic renormalization group in a minute. But in the CFD, you can compute some RG flow as you go from UV to IR. Notice I've already said that the IR is somehow in the interior. So if I've just told you that I have some non-CFT that flows from UV to IR, I should see a flow in the space-time. And there are examples, for example, this Lace-Strassler deformations and things like this, where you start off in the UV at one CFT fixed point, and then you add a deformation, and then it flows to another CFT fixed point. Then what you should see in the space-time is, if you construct the appropriate set of system here, that you should see the space-time deform as you go from infinity to inside, so that you go from sort of one set of these scaling dimensions, these two H bars and things that we compute, to another set of scaling dimensions. And that happens. And there are many lovely examples of that kind of thing happening. Another question. Oh yeah, it would do this. You can compute the second derivative of the action and compute exactly the same thing. Okay, very good. So we'll now change registers and sort of go in a slightly different direction. Okay, good. So that's the sort of basics, the complete basics of the ADS-CFT correspondence, the way you set it up and the way you calculate. And now I want to start talking more about, I want to take the next step about thinking about how you recover the bulk space-time. So the next thing I'm going to do is sort of, so to speak, spectroscopy of ADS, spectroscopy of ADS. So a part of the question of how you recover the space-time from the field theory is sort of trivial, as I will try to explain in a moment. As I've already explained, the symmetries of the space-time must be embedded in the symmetries of the field theory in order for this duality to hold. So what I want to explain to you is how that's realized in a concrete way so that a part of the problem of reconstructing space-time from the field theory is trivial. At least the part of the symmetry is trivial. So you should see how that works. So how do we see this? OK, fine. So as I said, anti-de Sitter space, we earlier argued, has an SOD, 2 isometry group. And so what's going to happen is if we solve the weight equation box phi is equal to m squared phi that we've written down here, you can organize this solutions in irreps of SOD, 2. This is simply, in effect, Fourier transforming in some suitable way. So that actually is a useful thing because it will teach us in a useful way how you organize in the bulk solutions to various equations and organize in the field theory the list of all operators you could write down and therefore how you match them up. There was a question earlier about how you find the operator. Was that from you? Okay, yeah. So this is part of the answer to the question. So for simplicity, let's just take ADS3, which you can write as minus u squared minus v squared plus x squared plus y squared is equal to minus l squared. This hyperboloid is ADS3, provided you endow it with a metric minus du squared minus dv squared plus dx squared plus dy squared is equal to ds squared. So you start off with a space with signature 2, 2, embed this hyperboloid, and that's ADS3. The metric that you get in this way, ds squared, just for purposes of, well, writing it down, minus cos squared mu dt squared plus d mu squared plus sinh squared mu d theta squared. And of course, there's an SO2, 2 isometry group. And SO2, 2 famously is isomorphic to SL2R cross SL2R. Okay. Now, this, we're talking about ADS3, three dimensions. How many dimensions is the dual? Somebody who isn't a professor. Oh, come on. Come on. You can do this. How many dimensions is the dual? Could you tell me, please? Anybody? Thank you. Yes, right? If you have ADS space in d plus 1 dimensions, the dual is always one less dimension. Okay. So many of you have written papers on this subject. OK, so the dual is two dimensions. So what's the conformal group in a two-dimensional conformal field theory? OK. Anybody? Tafid? Reassure me. Yes. 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 Yes, exactly. Exactly. OK. Am I going too fast? I am going too fast? How many people think I'm going too fast? How many people think I'm not going too fast? They're about even, so it's probably about right. But anyway. OK, we'll modulate, right? You should ask me questions, right? It'll help me to, it'll help slow me down. Just ask me questions, and it'll slow me down. You've already seen that. OK, so the conformal, so we are talking about here a three-dimensional ADS space, which has isometry group SO2, 2, which I said is the same thing as SL2R plus SL2R. And this happens to be the conformal group in two dimensions, which is, of course, exactly right. Because string theory in ADS3 is supposed to be dual to conformal theory, conformal field theory in two dimensions. So we're expecting those symmetries to agree. So what I want to do now, in the remaining 10 minutes, is to simply work out the representations of SL2R cross SL2R, both in the bulk and the boundary, and basically show you that it's guaranteed that because of the symmetries, that the towers of states that you can build must agree. And that in this sense, because the symmetries are realized, the dual field theory must somehow realize a part, well, somehow knows something about the bulk space-time. Because it's sort of organizing itself in basically Fourier representations of the bulk space-time. Yeah. I ignored that for the moment. The infinite dimensional part, of course, also arises in the bulk. I'll discuss that actually in a later lecture. So the point that is being raised by David is what I've described here is the global isometry group of the space-time. Brown and Hainaut many years ago showed that in addition, there is something called the asymptotic symmetry group of the space-time, which are symmetries that deform, those are deformations of the space-time that die off in the interior and do whatever they do near the boundary. So there's a class of deformations that realize then the full conformal group of the space, the full infinite dimensional conformal group. And of course, that full infinite dimensional conformal group is then matched onto the infinite dimensional conformal group in 1+1 dimension. I'm not discussing that in great detail because, of course, that's special to 1+1. For the ADS-5 case, there isn't an infinite dimensional conformal group. And so there's nothing to match in that way. But I'll talk about that actually tomorrow. Okay, so let's talk about this. So here's SL2R, and I'm doing sort of baby representation theory of SL2R. You can organize the SL2R as three generators, L0, L+, and L-. The algebra of the generators is L0 commutator L±, is equal to -+ L±. L++ commutes to 2L0. And the Casimir of the group is L² is equal to 1/2 L+L- plus L- L+ minus L0². Okay. So as I said, SL2R cross SL2R is the isometry group of the space-time. So that means that we can construct these generators of the symmetry, L0, L+, L-. Let's call this SL2R right, and let's call this SL2R left. We can construct, for example, the right generators as generators of the isometry group. Namely, if you write down all the generators of this SO2,2, you know, as differential operators, you can take linear combinations of them that will have commutation relations of this kind. I won't do it in detail on the blackboard because it's a somewhat ungodly mess to write down the actual formula, and it's not very instructive. Nevertheless, it's an exercise that you may want to do at home. Just write down these generators of these symmetries, and then simply take linear combinations to realize this commutation relations. So once you've done that, you can show that the wave equation box phi is equal to m² phi is the same thing as saying that L² plus L² times -2 is equal to m² L². And L0 times phi is equal to h phi will be the conformal weight that we talked about earlier. Okay, so what I've done here is, without working out the details of how you write L0, L+, and L- in terms of differential operators in space, that's an exercise that needs to be carried out in terms of the isometry generators. I've basically reduced the wave equation for the space-time into an algebraic relation between what L left and L right, between the eigenvalues of these various generators of symmetries acting on wave functions in the space-time. Okay. Is there an eraser? Oh. Okay. Very good. Okay, so how do you construct a representation of SL2R in this language? In other words, all solutions to the weight equation that fall into a single representation of SL2R. Well, the way you do that is you start out by saying, first you write down the highest weight state. So I'm going to look at highest weight representations of SL2R. So you first write down the highest weight state, which satisfies L plus, let's say, left acting on phi is equal to L plus right acting on phi is equal to 0. So in other words, the highest weight state is the one that's annihilated by the raising or lowering operators of your symmetry algebra. And then this winds up implying that L naught left acting on phi is L naught right acting on phi is equal to H, which is the conformal weight, as I said, of the representation. You can work out the Casimir. And HH minus 1 is equal to M squared L squared over 4, which then implies that the conformal weight can be H plus minus is equal to D over 2 plus or minus D squared plus 4M squared over 2. And then you solve to find that the highest weight state of the plus or minus variety is simply e to the minus I 2h plus minus t 1 over cosh mu 2h plus minus. That was a little confusing. Let me repeat what I said. So the way you construct the highest weight representations always is you take your annihilation operators and you ask that they annihilate the ground state of the representation, right? Then you have to solve for the ground state. So what I'm doing here is, I haven't written down the details of the differential operators, but I basically solve the details of the differential operators to find out what wave function phi is annihilated by the lowering operators of SL2R. Okay? So that gives me the ground state, if you like, of this representation. And I've just written down that solution over there. What you can now do, and it looks like this, as ground states always do, some nodeless wave function that's sort of localized somewhere. Now, if you want the full basis of states, basically all excited states of this scalar field, you now apply your raising operators, right, L minus left to the power p, L minus right to the power q, acting on the field, and this gives you the pq excited state. In other words, it's just like the harmonic oscillator, you raise and lower, and in this way, you can construct all solutions to the wave equation, and you know you can, because again, the wave equation turns out to be simply an equation for the Casimir of the group. So it's writing down all solutions, all things that are in particular. So if you take all things that are built in this way, they will all satisfy this Casimir equation by construction, and therefore, you know you have all solutions to the wave equation of, for the scalar field. Now, this is what we earlier worked out by solving the wave equation explicitly to get Bessel functions. Now, the virtue of doing this way is in the dual conformal field theory, this is exactly what you will do to work out all the representations of the theory, right? You take some combination of fields, make an operator, you work out its what conformal tower it lives in, you raise and you find the highest weight state in this way, and then you lower or raise the highest weight state using the raising and lowering operators of the conformal group. That's what you do in a conformal field theory. So the point of this argument is that it is evident that you're going to, at least if you identify for each field phi in the bulk, you identify the corresponding operator, O, in the dual, you will be able to generate the full conformal tower of states in an exactly parallel manner. And in effect, what that's doing is you're building a Fourier representation of the bulk physics, right? What you've done is you basically Fourier transformed the bulk fields to be organized in terms of their isometries. And in this way, it's evident that you recover part of the local structure of the bulk space-time. Because, you know, if you Fourier transform enough, if you take a sufficiently wiggly wave function, you get something that's fairly localized. Okay, so somehow that's not satisfying, because we just use the correspondence in a very naive way. We've said there's a field, there's an operator, and the field has wiggles, and I can make a field that has wiggles in its dual representation by just basically reproducing the effects of the wiggles as effects of a conformal transformation in the dual field theory. So that's not entirely satisfying, but it is a first step. And I'm almost out of time, so I'm going to stop here for today, and we'll pick it up from there. Yeah, question? What's that? Yeah, that shouldn't be evident. It's yeah. D is 2 here. Sorry, I have a tendency to write down the general formula, but this thing here is D over 2. Yeah. Thank you. Someone else had a question over there? Anything else? Or, oh, yeah, question? Could you speak louder? If you do what? I think you just added another piece of evidence to the statement that everything interesting in physics is the harmonic oscillator. Yes. Yeah, okay, yeah. Fair enough. Okay. Anything else? Yes. Yes. So if you work out the effects of these raising operators acting on this nodeless solution, you will discover that they produce nodes. They produce oscillations. So, I'm deliberately doing this in a non-explicit way, in an algebraic manner, because then the algebra, the algebra and the conformal field theory must line up, because by definition of it being a conformal field theory, this is the symmetry algebra of the conformal field theory. So whatever you do to construct your states there must line up with this. So it's evident that you will reproduce all of these structures, albeit in a very implicit way. Okay. Yeah. H times phi. Thanks. Yes? Hi. Yeah, no, it's certainly the global part. I mean, this is the non-anomalous part, but the great thing that we will sort of also briefly say, also in a later lecture, I guess, is that even the anomaly is realized here, right? From the gravity side, you can see the anomaly. So we don't have to feel embarrassed that the conformal group is anomalous in even dimensions. By the way, the fact that the conformal group is anomalous in even dimensions occasions great confusion in some sectors of the community. I mean, there are many, many disagreements that people have between different methods of computing mass, this, that, and the other, for ADS spacetimes, that in the end come down to the statement that the conformal group is anomalous, at least from our perspective, it's anomalous in even dimensions. And then, we account for that in a particular way, and some sectors of the community don't, and that leads to disagreements. So one should keep one's eye open always for that issue. Thank you for raising it. Yeah. You raised your hand. Yeah, you just bought a truck or something, you know. You were waving your hair, curling it. It's not very curly. You'll have to work hard there. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So those live in some kind of continuous representation. I've forgotten exactly what, because it's evident from this that these modes are quantized, right? Because, you know, they go in a discrete. So this is a discrete representation. So the non-renormalizable modes, if you look at the collection of all of them, they're actually in several representations. There's a particular discrete series that lives in one of the representations, and there's another. What's that? They're infinite dimensional. Yeah. Then there's another continuous series, and it's a mixture of representations. Well, the Casimir is always this, right? Given a Casimir, you can have many representations that have the same Casimir. Yeah, so as I said, there is a highest weight, I put the H plus and H minus here. There is a highest weight normalizable representation in this language. There's also highest weight representation, which is non-normalizable. But not all the non-normalizable modes are in that representation, as is evident because, well, another way of saying this is that when I said I want to use the non-normalizable modes to set the boundary conditions at infinity. Well, I would like to set arbitrary boundary conditions. And right, and since they don't fluctuate, so normally restrictions to sort of a discrete set of levels with a with the lowest energy, et cetera, come about because we want some sort of unitary theory. And it's unitarity that sets those bounds. Whereas these modes, these non-normalizable modes, at least in this language, are not fluctuating. So you're not obliged to impose any kind of unitarity condition on their fluctuations or anything. So you basically write down everything that you can. Okay. Any more questions? Goody. We're done.